From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, a key message mentors brought to girls on the fence about going into science and engineering.
It's okay. It's okay to be awkward. It's okay not to necessarily follow the crowd or fit in. And there were so many, like, eyes that opened up like, oh my gosh, that's me.
Later, the hot topics under discussion at this year's Wisconsin Bike Summit.
Plus, we talk with the director and star of the Milwaukee Rep's current production of Jane Eyre.
And at the Museum of Wisconsin Art, a Milwaukee artist looks back at a 40-year career.
It's sort of ironic, you know, I wanted to be Tom Bamberger the artist. I wanted people to know who I was. I wanted people to interview me on the radio. But when I was actually making the work, whenever I thought I was Tom Bamberger the artist, I always made lousy work.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. You may already be aware of the gender gap that exists in science and engineering fields in this country. Despite survey data that shows almost three-quarters of girls in middle school have an interest in science, math, or engineering, fewer than a third of women graduating from college seek careers in those fields.
A Milwaukee-based organization is using women who have gone into those fields to try to reach out to girls at an important stage of their education, high school. Todd and Jody Herbert founded the EGGS Initiative. The acronym stands for Engaging Girls in STEM. Todd Herbert explains why he thinks the gender gap has been so hard to close.
Well, I think in large part it has to do with the way in which we approach education. Girls are often looked at not being able to push forward in certain academic areas. Science has always been seen as a male-dominated an area, and so girls aren't often given that same chance to demonstrate their capabilities. So in part, it's the way educators look at it, but I also think it has to do with both our business environments, where we don't often give women the same opportunities that men are afforded.
Well, and so it's an interesting story about how the EGGS Initiative developed, and I'm curious just to have you walk us through, why did this end up on your radar screen, and why did you pursue the model that you did?
We had a close family friend who was struggling with a class assignment in a club that she belonged to. They were looking to bring in STEM professionals, preferably women, and she was struggling trying to find individuals that could come in and speak beyond those that they most often come in contact with, nurses, their family physicians, and so forth. They were looking for engineers. They were looking for scientists. They were looking for people in tech. So over the course of the conversation, we said, well, maybe we can introduce you to some individuals. I having been in corporate education for a number of years, what I found is that there weren't as many people in my network. There were women that were in STEM careers, and that was kind of an aha moment for myself. So that became, I think, the genesis for our conversation at home as to, you know, why is this the case? We don't know STEM professionals. We couldn't actually help our friend out in this situation. So how could we go about, changing that and contributing to her success? And so that one-time project led to a larger effort, which is what's become the EGGS Initiative. And then what we did is saw that there was some potential with that, and we ended up building this program, which after 4 years is now involving over 200 girls from over 25 high schools.
So when this light bulb moment hit for you and you started getting in contact with the people in your network, say the women who were engineers and scientists and involved otherwise in tech fields, did they report the same thing?
I believe that it was, and in fact, they were very, very happy to be part of this effort because of the shortcomings that they, in turn, experienced as young women trying to get into these STEM-related fields.
Well, and so from that moment and the point at which you decided this needed to be a larger effort, what did you decide the approach would be once you had these people all kind of coming together? What's the tool you're using to try to make a difference?
Developing relationships. My husband did a lot of groundwork connecting with a variety of different STEM-related career women with area high schools. And it was really interesting because we had, it seemed, no difficulty accumulating lots of interest among the women professionals. I think that the biggest difficulty or challenge or roadblock, however you want to look at it, had to do with the kids and getting high school girls involved. That was a bit of a struggle.
Yeah, I think what we've found is that for high schools, there's obviously the academic focus, but the pre-professional component is not something that's on their radar screen. On the other side, with the professional women we spoke to, they quickly recognize the challenges that girls face because there isn't a lot of exposure. Boys have their fathers typically showing them everything from how to handshake to how to introduce yourself in a setting that is not typical of the classroom. So for us, we started to realize, talking with the women, that girls needed to have a similar kind of exposure. So the way we organized our event is to make it more of a professional association situation instead of a classroom situation. So we don't offer our programs in schools. We do them in business settings. This past year, we're doing it at Johnson Controls and at the medical college. That reinforces the idea that the girls need to start thinking of themselves as professionals, to engage with other professional women in a manner that will be more suitable in a work environment.
Right. So what happens at these workshops?
The young ladies will enter early in the morning, usually around 8:30 on a Saturday. So that's a big commitment, too. They come in and they're offered a card that allows them to see the plan for their morning. And they become involved in a series of roundtable discussions with a variety of different professionals. There is a networking opportunity for them to learn how to be a professional once they move beyond high school and into careers.
I guess I wanted to go back for a moment to the roadblock that you were talking about, idea of that high school age girls aren't necessarily, you know, raising their hands and saying they want to be part of this. How have you been able to overcome those roadblocks?
It's been a bit tedious. I think that there's one woman who's been very integral and very forthcoming in terms of sharing her idea of how to be successful in that area. And this is a woman from Waukesha Schools. And she believes that it's the relationships that teachers, particularly science or technology or math teachers, if they happen to be women, create with the young ladies in their classes who they feel would be suitable and have strong interest in the STEM areas. And through those relationships, she fosters the idea of going and doing a variety of different extracurricular kinds of activities like eggs.
So what we find is that it's the one-on-one, I mean, throughout this the entire program, small roundtable discussions with a STEM professional, high school teachers reaching out to individual students and letting them know, we believe this is a beneficial program, we believe you can gain from this process, and we think you would be successful at this. Again, the reinforcement of why networking is extremely important in your long-term success, and we're modeling that right from the get-go, teachers introducing the girls, girls introducing themselves to the professionals introducing them to what it's like in the real world.
There are a number of organizations out there that are kind of devoted to STEM education. There are lots of tech companies. How has the process of connecting all of the dots been for you?
For us, a big part of this is getting to know some of the different professional organizations. Girls at Code, the Society for Women Engineers, the CFP Society, all of those are great ways for us to meet different professionals, but not just to meet and find additional individuals who could serve as role models at the workshop, but also to collect from them some of the challenges that they're facing so that can be reflected in the program itself. We've never had, as Jody was saying, we've never had a problem finding professionals wanting to work with us. But what we've always are seeking is guidance as to what is the most relevant topics that we should be bringing forward for these girls to have with these professional women.
What would you hope after, you know, spending a day in one of these workshops? I mean, you know, the workshops can't be every day. So what do you hope the lasting impact is when a high school girl goes to, you know, spends a day, a Saturday, in the company of these professional women? What should they still be thinking about the next Friday or 3 weeks later or 6 months later?
That this is possible for me. This is something that I can do, that I hoped, dreamt maybe, I know that this is, I tend to gravitate maybe toward these areas of academia, but it could possibly result in a career path for me. And it's really interesting. I was at one of the sessions just sort of looking on at the Johnson Controls workshop. And one of the issues that was brought up by the facilitator was that it's okay to be awkward. It's okay not to necessarily follow the crowd or fit in. And there were so many, like, eyes that opened up, like, oh, my gosh, that's me. So we hope that they find a way that they could relate to the professionals and then to take that forward as a possible path for themselves.
A big part of this is the confidence, as Jody's talking about, that will help them as they pursue their academic career and then ultimately their professional career. And also recognizing that the network, because it's a big part of what the program is designed to do, their network will be integral to their long-term success. So who you know and who knows you will ultimately help you be more successful, not just in the jobs that you might acquire, but in terms of getting guidance to be better at what you're doing.
Now, there's some people who make the point that there are many tech companies who are specifically looking for people with a liberal arts background and not necessarily people coming out of the traditional tech degrees, the engineering degrees, the math degrees. How does the idea of a broad-based education enter the picture in your work?
Oh, gosh. The women that we have at the program, without exception, talk about the importance of a liberal arts education. You need to be more than a technocrat. You need to know more than the design ideas. You need to understand beyond the math. You will need to be able to relate. The creativity comes from those other courses. So a liberal arts background is highly recommended by almost without exception, right?
And it allows them to develop their skills in communicating, both orally and in writing.
Is there also an important message? I mean, do the role models make the point that this won't always be easy?
Oh, clearly.
Yes, yes. And there will be struggles along the way, cyclically, that they will have to work through, but just to have the confidence in themselves to push through those struggles.
Are there growth plans for the Eggs Initiative?
We keep being asked that.
Well, we are retired. We're excited with the interest and the encouragement that we received. What we really want to do is provide a vision for what's possible. Our program, coupled with others, I think Girls at Code, Girls on the Run, a number of these kinds of programs are trying to encourage girls to look at themselves more positively, to see what's possible in their careers. The more we can collaborate, I think we, in addition to everybody else, can ensure that at least here in Milwaukee, we have more girls going forward confident and strong in their beliefs of what's possible in their careers.
Todd and Jody Herbert are retired educators and founders of the EGGS Initiative. The acronym stands for Engaging Girls in STEM. You'll find a link to more about the initiative and the next workshop they have scheduled for later this month at WUWM.com.
The Wisconsin Bike Federation holds its annual bike summit today in Milwaukee. We'll hear about why the city of Racine decided bicycles are a big part of its future when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.
Things better by working together. It's a simple message, and it comes from the heart. Believe in yourself.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Bike advocates from Wisconsin and the region will spend much of the day indoors today in downtown Milwaukee at UWM's School of Continuing Education.
The occasion is the Wisconsin Bike Federation's 2017 Bike Summit. Among the hot topics is the City of Racine's first bicycle master plan, which is nearing completion. Dottie K. Bowersox is the city's public health administrator and, as you'll hear, an enthusiastic and avid cyclist herself.
She told Lake Effect Susan Benz that it was just 2 years ago, in 2015, that two people got Racine on track to create this master plan.
with two wonderful community members by the name of John Antino and John Siegert. Those two individuals, along with members of the KR, the Kenosha Racine Bike Club, got together and decided that Racine, the city of, needed a comprehensive pedestrian bicycle master plan. And with that, to augment or to integrate with Kenosha, Milwaukee, and some of the outlining areas within the county of Racine. Siegert and Antino started writing grants and asking for money, and then the KR Bike Club proceeds from our annual ride. We put that together. We got SC Johnson, we got the Rotary Foundation, the Racine Community Foundation, Twin Disc, along with a little bit of money from the city of Racine. We think, from what we can ascertain, that we are the only major city bike pedestrian master plan in the Midwest that's been mostly privately funded. So it really gives us a good feeling about the fact that this is a really community-oriented process and program.
Recently had your last public hearing, right?
Yes, it is.
I wish you'd be a little more excited. So, what was your turnout and what did people have to say?
Yeah, this was our third meeting, community meeting. Each one of them has surpassed the numbers or the expectations of the previous one, and more so than what's been seen in the state of Wisconsin and other jurisdictions. This time we had a list of recommendations that we provided, and then we asked individuals to vote so that we can go through the prioritization process.
What kind of biking, let's call it infrastructure, currently exists in Racine? And are you, again, now you're blending Racine and Kenosha?
Yeah, well, and what we're taking a look at is that these other jurisdictions obviously have had master bike plans, pedestrian plans for a period of time.
Okay.
And we want to make sure that within our trail systems that we're interconnected with that. And that's where the Rails to Trail Conservatory, they've also been a huge contributor to us. They provided low-stress connectivity plan for us on our streets, but also taking a look at those trails to make sure that we're all together. And they're working on the Route of the Badger, which, you know, I'm very honored to be part of that group as well, to be able to make that happen. But for us, what we're looking at is that we have short-term and we have long-term, medium-term goals. We're looking at intersections. About 1% of the cycling population is what is termed fearless. And those are individuals that will ride anywhere under any conditions.
And that may or may not be good.
Yeah, may or may not be good. Depends on the day. But nonetheless, it's a great adventure. So I suggest everyone partake at some point. At the same time, there's about 60% the overall population of potential bike riders that would like to do more, and they would like to go further, and they'd like to be more frequent. At the same point, they're concerned about their safety, which, you know, is understandable. At the same point, within our recommendations, we're looking at intersections. So how do you get from point A to point B in a congested area? We're also looking at road configurations. We're looking at signage. We're looking at neighborhood greenways, and we're looking at bike lane recommendations throughout the city comprehensively.
What kind of existing bike trails and, you know, marking does Racine have?
Yeah, well, we've got our pathway system, which goes along the shore of Lake Michigan, which, you know, we've got a beautiful shoreline, Pershing Park, Lake Michigan, going out to North Beach and up and around, and then connects with the county trail system. So we already have a trail system in existence for individuals, but part of the problem is signage. You know, some of the signs are pretty small, so, you know, once you're on a street, you know, because you're on the trail, you're off the trail, you know, a street, you know, you may get to a certain point where you've got an intersection and you've got to make a left, but you didn't see the trail sign until about 10 feet ago, and there's no way for you to get over with traffic and such. So, you know, you've got to be careful. So we want to make sure that, you know, as part of one of our recommendations is a signage, that individuals have a notification early enough to be able to make those lane changes. We've got a couple of intersections that we've got some major concerns with, and those potentially could be high-cost items. At the same point, we've got other roads in which the bike lanes just need to be extended. You know, we need paint. And we need time. So our DPW or whomever would come forward and say, yeah, we can extend that bike lane. The road is already wide enough. We just need more bike lane. You know, other roads that we're looking at that need greenery or that need a road diet, you know, reducing it from maybe a 4-lane to a 2-lane because the traffic is not calling for that much pavement. So taking those lanes and making them bike lanes, you know, on each side. So, and so there's some other areas that, again, there is cost involved, but they're not extensive in, you know, high value items.
Now, did people show up at any of these hearings saying these bikes are in our way?
Oh, individuals, yes, we've had comments about courtesy and about appropriateness and about a proper usage of bicycles, also about visibility, you know, in the age of cyclists, you know, cutting in and out of traffic and their children. So, yes, we've had those conversations as well. And whether you're a bicyclist or you're a bike rider, there are appropriate rules of the road that need to be followed, just as a motor vehicle, and very similar to what a motor vehicle. But most importantly is visibility and really paying attention to the traffic. So we've had a series of discussions about that, about, you know, taillights and front lights and visible clothing. You know, individuals don't need to dress up in spandex and glow in the dark kind of thing, but they need to be seen readily and quickly and be appropriate for that. So
that fits into your planning? You want to reinforce those messages?
Yeah. Plus the fact, you know, just today I was reading the paper and again, pedestrian deaths are up. And that's why the intersections are so important to take a look at those. And whether, you know, it's distracted drivers or distracted pedestrians, that number is unacceptable. It's the highest number it's been in 40 years, which I find to be amazing. But nonetheless, you know, intersection and have availability of sidewalks is really important. So individuals really need to pay attention, you know, no texting, no telephone, phones, you know, no smartphones, no, you know, whatever. And I walk to work every day and I'm an avid cyclist, but at the same point, I've got lights on my bag, you know, I've got reflective clothing. I make sure all the traffic is come to a complete stop at the front and at the back before I cross the road. I've had too many incidents over the years that individuals have run red lights. You know, they just aren't paying attention. They, you know, they park, you know, they stop on the crosswalks. I mean, I don't know, all sorts of things.
So what's the next step? I mean, you said you're going through the recommendations. And you'll be at a point soon to take it to the City Council?
Yes, we will, and I'm so excited about this. We've been working with the Wisconsin Bike Federation, excellent group, and we do have an advisory council, wonderful group of individuals that are donating their time, energy, and efforts to help move this process along and give us their best input, which they are highly intelligent individuals. Great group, I love them. Finishing up in the month of May and heading toward council after that. So we've got Bike Week coming up, the first full week in June, and we're hoping to be able to have comprehensively parts and pieces and collectively to be able to give the public and say, okay, this is what we're doing and this is where we're going. We're asking individuals to let their aldermen know how important this is. We'll publicly announce the meetings. We want individuals there to support us and to let them know that this is important and this is a framework that we want to engage in and fully engage in the implementation of.
Okay, personal question. How many bicycles do you have?
Oh. I'm on the low end in comparison with some of the people that I ride with, but I've got two road bikes, I've got one mountain bike, and I'm looking for a new gravel bike, so.
Dottie K. Bowersox is Public Health Administrator for the City of Racine. She spoke with Lake Effect's Susan Bentz.
Racine's Bicycle Master Plan is one of the topics of discussion at the Wisconsin Bike Fed's 2017 Bike Summit, which takes place today at the UWM School of Continuing Education in downtown Milwaukee. You'll find a link to more about it and a previous interview we did about the planned Root of the Badger project at WUWM.com.
Keep listening. We'll take another break and then get the story of the Milwaukee Reps production of Jane Eyre when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. If you ever had an English literature class, it's very likely you read the Charlotte Bronte classic Jane Eyre. The mid-19th century novel of class, madness, and love is one of the defining works of the canon. There have been many adaptations on stage and screen, and a very recent one is now on stage at the Milwaukee Rep.
KJ Sanchez directed, and Margaret Ivy stars as the eponymous Jane Eyre, and they joined me in the studio recently. Ivy says it's one of the most difficult roles she's taken on as an actor.
It sings in different ways. Different lines will hit you, or words or verbs will just jump out at you in different ways and resonate, I think, with a lot of what's going on for women in this country at this time, and what's going on for me and my growth as an artist, too. It's beautiful to hear every night after night.
Polly Teal did a great job with the adaptation. The adaptation and the story, there are so many layers to it, and it speaks to us on so many different levels that even though we opened it in Cincinnati and it ran for 39 performances there. Yeah. Now we're very familiar with it, but every day we listen to it and find new things in it. And you know it's a rich text when we're on breaks, all of the other actors come out and they sit in the house because they want to watch the next scene. And so too with the crew, we're finding that the crew, when they're not busy doing something, they run out and they sit in the front row. We had a scene the other night, a beautiful, the main romantic love scene between Jane and Rochester when they finally admit that they're in love with each other. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house. And it was, you know, all of the crew ran out to watch this and we were all just bawling. It's so present. It speaks so directly to us now. It's heartbreaking and it's inspiring. And you're right, it says so much about where we are as women and where we are as a society.
In case there are people listening who don't know the story of Jane Eyre and why this is so important for now, do you want to give us a quick synopsis of the story?
Yeah, Jane Eyre is an orphan. Her parents have passed away. She's from the aristocratic class. However, her parents left her in the care of an aunt who completely abuses her and eventually throws her away and sends her to a school for girls. And the school for girls is notoriously brutal. They're literally starving girls to death. And through her whole childhood, she is a really honest girl. She's not afraid to speak her mind. She's absolutely authentic. She doesn't know how to be charming or cute. All she knows what to do is tell the truth, and she's despised by everyone in her life. She's abused by her cousin. She's thrown away by her aunt. She's abused by this school. And so growing up, she's told, you don't fit. You're not right. You're not charming. You're not cute. You're plain. And just at the point where she figures that she should listen to this and believe all these things about her, just at this point when she's where we all get to at some point where we think we don't deserve love, she meets Rochester. And because of his given circumstances, he comes from a lot of personal pain as well. The two of them find themselves in this moment where neither of them feel like they deserve love. And yet they meet their kindred spirit. They meet the person that they were meant to be with. They meet that one special person that you know the instant you see them, that you want them in your life for the rest of your time on earth and maybe even continuing. And it's hard because they have a lot of things in their way.
They both bring a lot of baggage and they both have to work through a lot.
They really do. And what I love about this story, because I'll admit, I didn't love a lot of books from this time period growing up. I didn't relate to them as well. But this one is different because it's gritty and it's real and it's a little spooky. There's a lot of gothic influence. There's just some mystery to it. And there's all of these dark secrets. Like in life, we have to work through each other's baggage before we can get to the point of saying I do. So I love that it is true to life in that way.
I remember, you know, that was the inspiration for the book. I think it came out in the 80s, The Mad Woman in the Attic.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of the idea of what happens to women in culture. And that this book is so important for feminist theory, for ways of thinking about women in art, in culture, and it just keeps being reinvented in some ways and rediscovered.
And we keep suffering from the same issues. I mean, however you voted in the last election, I don't think there's a person who will deny that Hillary was scrutinized because of how she looked. I mean, the pantsuit was such a huge thing. Why was the pantsuit such an issue? I would have rather everybody talk about all of the, like, skeletons in the closet and all of those things. But it came down to her likability. And why does society demand that we be likable?
That you have charm and that you have pliability.
Pliability is such a great word. That's exactly it.
And one of the things I love about this adaptation of the play is that it captures the fact that Jane just won't do that.
That's right.
She kind of does when she's forced to.
Right.
But she does it basically saying, I'm doing this because you're forcing me to, not because I want to or believe in it.
She tries. I was just rereading the foreword to the edition I have, and the author talks about how it's a parable of repression. and how she tries to push down those things as I do in my life, as all of us do, trying to be a good girl, trying to have it all together, trying to say the right thing. But she is too much who she is. She is too much of a survivor, an artist, an intellect to settle for being anything less than a full human being.
I think that maybe that's what resonates from the book and also from this play, is that we recognize that in her, that we all want to be seen as who we are.
Yeah, and we all want to make sense of who we are when we feel like we're an outlier or an outcast or a weirdo. And that was my relationship with the play, with the book, rather. I read it when I was 13, and I was a weird kid. You know, I was the last of 12 kids, and I was growing up on a ranch, and I was a terrible cowgirl. I was so bad. My animals were always pee-stained, and we'd take them to the fair, and they were always overweight, or my rabbit bit the judge, my lamb knocked the judge over and jumped over the fence and ran away. Like, I didn't know how to be a good cowgirl. And then at 19, I went to New York City for the first time, and I looked around and went, oh, I'm a New Yorker that was born on a ranch in New Mexico. I get this. I know how this works. So when I was 13 and feeling really lonely and I was just such a weirdo and I didn't have any friends, I read that book and Jane Eyre was my first best friend. You know, she was my role model because she didn't fit in, and eventually she finds her way and she gets her voice, and not only that, she gets her man, and, you know.
She finds her place.
She finds her place, and by saying, and it's a beautiful combination because she's not only just a rebel. What's so remarkable about the book is, and about how Margaret is playing her, I think, particularly, is that she's rebellious and she's forthright and she's going to stand up for herself. And yet, you know, we would assume that all of those attributes lead somebody to be more of an agnostic when it comes to their spiritual life. But she has such a clear understanding of her moral compass, and she has this beautiful relationship to her God, and she goes to her God for solace. So she's unbelievably complicated that way. And part of the barrier between her and Rochester is her own sense of what is right in terms of her own faith and spiritual journey.
Right, the fact that she has faith.
She does. She has a very strong faith. And her friend Helen teaches her about God and teaches her that there is this world of spirits that care for us and that there's a way of rising above the trials of this life, because if you have God, then you have an inner strength. And it's really interesting for me to chart her faith journey, starting out as something that's just trying to make her more of a good girl, and then really blossoms into this thing that gives her strength as she goes throughout her life, and that she struggles against. She struggles to hear God's voice. She struggles to know what is the path that she should be on, and has really active conversations. It feels like he is a character in the play along with her.
I want to talk a little bit about how you're staging this. How has it changed from what was in Cincinnati?
The theater here is so much more intimate. Cincinnati has a really deep house, and so they had to, the performances needed to be really broad and big and really like send their energy to the far, far back of the space. And though the Powerhouse is a big space, it's very, very intimate. So I'm so happy to be here because in so many ways we're going back to the essence of the play that we found in the rehearsal room. It's always a little heartbreaking when you're working on something and you build it in the rehearsal room and you find this perfect, you build this perfect little jewel, and then you go into a big space and it kind of breaks, has to break apart a little bit because you have to project it so much. And this space is just the perfect room for it. So
well, and you've got the three-quarter, too. I mean, you're almost fully three-dimensional.
That's right. The audience really feels like the actors are in their laps, and they're really going along the journey together. I don't know if you've seen some of the photographs, but the mise-en-scène, the scenery is very, very modern. It's a series of ramps and a box and then a room on top of the box. Chris Stone did the design, and she's so genius. And her driving impulse was to connect the set to Jane's essence as much as possible. And so the set, when you walk in, it's really plain. And then it becomes beautiful based on how it's put to use. And how it interacts with the actors then suddenly reveals all of this beauty. So it's, you know, we just like doubled down in the old adage, don't judge a book by its cover. You know, you're not going to see grand castles or sweeping wars, but I guarantee what you do see is going to be pretty beautiful. I'm so proud of the design.
I love that you put it that way, because I'd never thought before of the space as a metaphor for Jane herself, that on the surface it's not anything remarkable, but then as you see it in a different light, literally and figuratively, there's more going on.
And that's the first thing that gets Rochester about Jane is when he falls off of his horse, the first thing she does is run to him and say, can I help you? You know, she's a girl. Girls are supposed to be receding and run away from men on moors in the middle of
men.
A strange man in the middle of the
falling
night.
Falling off horses.
And she runs right up and picks him up. She's never afraid to help, which is the deepest kind of beauty.
K.J. Sanchez directed and Margaret Ivy stars in the current production of Jane Eyre on stage at the Milwaukee Rep through May 21st. You'll find much more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take one more break and then we'll have a conversation with Tom Bamberger as a retrospective of his photography is showing at the Museum of Wisconsin Art. You are listening to Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM.
Pictures of people taking pictures.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie Moore.
And I'm Mitch Teich. You've heard Tom Bamberger's voice on this show many times. He is one of the city's leading architectural and public space critics, but he's also a nationally acclaimed photographer. Bamberger recently donated more than 400 of his works to the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend.
About a quarter of those photographs are on display through May 21st at the museum. I met up with the artist and with museum director and exhibit curator Lori Winters recently to take a look at the photos.
How does it feel to be curated after being a curator yourself?
Oh, it's fine.
Is it?
Oh, God, yes.
Is it nice to have somebody else look at your stuff?
Well, it's just a... we have a real collaboration. Most artists have a very low opinion of curators, if the truth be known, because they don't really believe that a curator could really has the time between all the parties and fundraising to actually understand their work in the way that they think the public should understand it. But in this case, Lori came every Sunday for months. So when we would have a discussion, we'd look at some pictures and look at the book. So Lori would come and there would be pictures in the book or the arrangement, and like 4 out of 10 times I would say, you know, I think we should switch this picture. And Lori would say, why? And I'd say, I think this is the reason. And Lori would say, you're right. But 6 out of 10 times, the other 6 times when I said, you know, I think we should switch this picture, Lori, normally the curator would say, okay, you're the artist or whatever, but Lori would say, no, I think you're wrong and this is why. And then I would say, you're right. So that's really an unusual situation.
Is that usual for you from the curatorial side to have an artist actually engage with you in that way, Lori?
The process of working with Tom was somewhat unique, obviously because I've known him for 20 years. So I sort of know his personality and sort of quirks, and he knows mine. We have the same sort of values about art, and in this case, you know, that meshed really well. I mean, it was a terrific collaboration.
How long did it last before you actually hung the pictures on the wall?
I mean, the idea was sort of in genesis for about a year, and we were working every Sunday for, you know, 6 months or more, and that meant sort of starting, you know, at the most sort of fundamental level, which was just sort of organizing the collection initially. And then once we'd gotten beyond that, just sort of deciding what might come to the museum, then deciding what would be in the exhibition. And mixed in with that was, you know, the conversation about the work of art and, you know, what was the catalyst for it? What was the thinking? What was the evolution? And I have to say that was really interesting. You know, I liked Tom's work and have liked it for 20 years, but there is a kind of coherency and logic that has emerged as a consequence of this exhibition. So Tom will be happy to know he makes sense now.
You make sense now, Tom?
Yeah, but you know, the coherence, me, the artist, when you go backwards and you look at it, there is really, there's lots of different paths you could find through 40 years of work. when the path that Lori found is a particularly, well, a really good one, but it's not my job to find that path. My job is just to go forward. And what I realize, and as an artist, all you do is you go forward and you don't really know why you do things. In my view, the best artists do a lot of dumb stuff. You have to have the courage to do stuff, and then most of it doesn't work and you just keep going forward. So the through line, the narrative line, I think what Lori discovered is that the only gift I really had was to plod in small steps forward. So it took 40 years, and I actually did go forward, but I never had an idea about how to go forward. I actually went forward by, you know, walking backwards. I don't think any of my gifts I deserve. If there anything good happened, it's not because it's just that I just happened to move forward. So this is a very long journey. You don't see too many artists that keep going as long. And I think one of the reasons is that, you know, I stayed in Milwaukee. If I would have gone to New York, I would have been a famous artist and I'd have to go to all these parties. And you know what I mean?
He's on the party thing. Is he not been invited to enough, Lori? Is that what's going on?
No, Ansel Adams once asked Edward Weston, you know, how do you keep doing it? Because Ansel Adams became famous and then he just stopped. And Weston's kept going. And Weston's answer was, oatmeal. He ate a lot of oatmeal, but what he really did is Ansel Adams liked going to parties. He played the piano, he got drunk, he hung out with beautiful women, and Weston just sort of sat, you know, he hung out with beautiful women too, but he ate a lot of oatmeal and just kept going.
And kept working.
Yes, and kept working and moving forward. So I think Milwaukee was like, Milwaukee for me was like oatmeal for Edward Weston.
Well, he calls it oatmeal, but I would say that it's really sort of curiosity. There is this kind of curious mind in Tom's work. And you can sort of see him experimenting with different themes, different subjects, and then, you know, it's sort of like a sort of 2 to 5 year intervals. And, you know, he'll fully sort of explore something and then completely drop it. And it never gets picked up again. But there is a thread that carries through. It's that curious mind. It's an interest in, you know, resolution. It's an interest in the quality of grays and blacks. And it's an interest in just sort of the surface of things. And that can be people or it can be sort of landscapes. But it's sort of interesting, you know. Tom, well, we know him today as a kind of landscape photographer, if we want to say that. But, you know, you look back at the work from the late 70s and 80s, and it's all figurative. So,
you know, you're doing a lot of portraiture. I'm seeing it. We're standing in front of
it. I was the guy that you'd hire at Milwaukee Magazine. If you did something bad and they were writing an article about you, they sent me. No, I'm serious. And I wonder why no one ever caught on. You know, seriously, like if there was going to be a bad article about you, they would send Tom. Because I took serious photographs. I tried to do real editorial photographs rather than corporate, you know. Actually, you know what else I was trying? I was trying to impress people. That's the other thing I've done my whole life is try to impress people when I wasn't trying to be a good artist or I tried to work them together. But
that's an interesting thought, the idea. I think most artists, whether they're visual artists or performers or whatever, they do want to impress people. There's a certain need to connect and to have that feedback.
Well, I tell you, it's when you look back as an older person onto it, it's painful. Artists like to think of themselves as these people that are worried about the big ideas. You know, other people are just going shopping. But in fact, here's Adam Gopnik in The New Yorker, and all he's doing is trying to show you how much smarter he is than someone else. When I write, you know, that's a big, unfortunately, when you're younger, you need ego it's like the booster rocket to get you into orbit. But I hate to say it, but I mean, when the ego starts going away, it really does change things. But that is the thing that's what launches you, I think.
Do you think, Lori, that is evident in this collection of 40 years, that there is something at the beginning that's much more ego-driven and that things change over the course of those 40 years?
I would almost say no. Yeah. I mean,
The artwork is different. My artwork was a refuge from myself. That's what saved me. That was the drug. It was the time where I didn't have to be. It's sort of ironic, you know, I wanted to be Tom Bamberger, the artist. I wanted people to know who I was. I wanted people to interview me on the radio. But when I was actually making the work, whenever I thought I was Tom Bamberger, the artist, I always made lousy work. There's something humiliating about art, you know, the process. And As I said this before, you know, I could never cheat on art. I always paid the price. Whenever I thought I was a great artist, I made terrible art.
Well, you know, it's interesting to look at Tom's first work, you know, the sort of the first 2 to 3 years of his career. You know, he gets this camera as a wedding gift, and he's working by himself. All he's doing is just trying to figure out how to use the camera. And at a certain point, he decides to take it seriously, and he spends the next 2 years just photographing the pavement, you know, sort of giving new definition to street photography. I mean, all he's doing is literally shooting the pavement beneath his feet. I don't find anything sort of egotistical about that. I think that's very private and personal, and it's a kind of intellectual endeavor.
It was starting out as something really basic. It was literally looking down and understanding the photographic process that captures all this information and this incredible density, and then there's light, and then there's the film, you know, developing the film. It was just a kind of a petri dish for me.
Yeah.
And all I wanted to do is learn, and learn about the process, and then you learn about the process, and you learn about seeing. But photography and art for me was always, it was sort of like, imagine you're an astronomer, and you're looking at the stars, and, you know, looking at the universe, and then all of a sudden you get a telescope. It's like, whoa, I can see so much more. But the creative process for me was always like an instrument, like a scientific instrument that allowed me to learn stuff and discover stuff. It was a research project.
Was there ever a point for you when you thought, oh wait, this is art? Not just a research project?
Well, yeah, but even after that, it was still a research project. I was doing this, and a friend of mine was actually a student of Steve Foster's. And I was just like, you know, there's so many ways to be a hobbyist forever in photography and never. And he just kept on saying, you know, this might be art. You should show it to Steve Foster. I didn't want to be an artist. And, you know, frankly, the art world was kind of a downer compared to the world, the intellectual world that I aspired to and came from. I mean, it wasn't like an upgrade. You know, I've gone through mostly the back door of everything in my life, not the front door.
So, Laurie, talk a bit about the collection in general. How much of Tom's work does the museum now have in its permanent collection?
Well, Tom's gift to the museum is just shy of 400 works, and most of them are not small scale. There's one photograph that's 35 feet long and another photograph that's 22 feet long. And so it's a lot of square footage of Tom Bamberger in the museum. Obviously, we couldn't do a show, nor should we, of 400 works. So we were selective and have out about 128, I think, altogether. And we published 128 in the catalog that accompanies the exhibition.
How hard was it to choose?
Not as hard as you might think. There are certain works that very clearly sort of encapsulate a period, a time frame, that are just gorgeous. There were certain works where, you know, you could sort of see Tom just sort of experimenting on the side, but wasn't necessarily representative of a period of his work. And in that case, I think we left some of that material out. And you know, at the opening of the exhibition, I gave a little speech, which was a little teary-eyed, I have to confess, because the time I spent with Tom looking at the work was an experience that I will just always treasure. I mean, he sees things in a way that I never will. So he kind of gave me a gift, and that was just really important. It was important to me, and I feel like now that he has given this gift to the museum, he's giving it to everyone who comes here to visit.
So, Tom, did you approach Laurie in the museum, or did they approach you? How did you decide to make the gift?
Well, basically, a friend of mine came over. He showed me some work. He was a photographer. I said, you know, it reminds me of the pavement picture. So I took the pavement pictures out, and he looked at them, and he went, oh, my God, these are so great. And then I took another bunch out. I had never looked at my work. And, you know, when you're a photographer, you really think you're an adult when you're finally buying these huge flat files that you see at architecture's office. Yeah, they're really expensive, but now you got to store all these big, you know, like you got to be. So I started looking with my friend Chris, and I decided that I was going to give them away. And partly when I was a curator, you know, you go see an old photographer and they'd be sitting with all these flat files and old pictures and old stories. That just sort of creeps me out personally for me. I think most of my old stories are lies anyways, so might as well go forward, you know? I mean, you know, we make them up, we keep practicing. I decided, I asked a couple people, Lori was one of them, just say, hey, do you want to see? I'm taking this stuff out of my closet or, you know, my safe or whatever. I want to show you my work, you know? And Lori took me up on it. It was really her engagement. We didn't even talk about the gift, I don't think. I don't know if you remember.
It just sort of happened.
Yeah, so I just sort of, no, afterwards, well, usually Lori's two steps ahead of me, and this, I might have been 1.5 steps ahead of her just for a brief moment. And that moment was, you know, I had all this work and I really wanted to give it away. And so at some point, you know, Lori, it was sort of a fait accompli by the time we actually had the conversation. It was already, you know.
It was understood.
People always ask me the question, so why are you giving your work away? It's really hard for artists or people to understand why you'd give it all away. And I had to think about it, and I finally came up with a succinct explanation, and that is, if you're a writer or whatever kind of creative person you are, if you do it for a while, it turns out that your work has a life of its own. Just like if you were writing a novel, there's a point where the novel has a life of its own, where you're not the all-seeing God, you're saying, what is this character going to do now? It has a life of its own. So what I did is I made sure my artwork went to a good grade school and then, you know, went to a good high school and probably had to go to a child psychologist at some point, got into a good college and graduate school. And finally, you know, I'm just thinking, well, when are you going to get your own apartment? And that's kind of the way I feel about this. It's really...
It was time for the artwork to move out.
Yeah, it's like, get your own apartment. Yeah, you know, like... I mean, that's really true. I know it sounds funny, but, you know, I love you, but you got to get your own apartment. And also, you know, the one thing about art that I'm the worst at is the sort of librarian, you know, like Lori knows with like check. I never did checklists when I was at the art museum. So in a way, Lori comes in and, you know, with an organized mind and so forth. And it's really, this is such a gift for me. Like when you talk about like what a big, generous guy I am, I think just the opposite. You know, the museum's been unbelievably generous. And this exhibition, the way it fits into this building, it's unprecedented in my lifetime. I have never seen a photography exhibition that has this power and immediacy. This is where Lori and I really had an identity of interests. You know, we really did have the exact same interest, and that was just to do a great show. And that's great for the institution. It's great for me.
And it's great for the people seeing it.
It's great for the people seeing it.
Tom Bamberger Hyper Photographic is on display at the Museum of Art in West Bend through May 21st. Bamberger is also the subject of a feature in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. We spoke with him and with museum director and exhibit curator Lori Winters at the Museum of Wisconsin Art. And there is a link to much more at WUWM.com. That is all for the Thursday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air comes your way next.